Hello, everyone, and welcome back to DASCO Up for Discussion. We are here to talk about all things Down syndrome, whether you're a parent, a self-advocate, a sibling, an educator, or someone looking to learn more. This space is for you. I'm your host, Sarah Sewell, the Executive Director for the Down Syndrome Association of Central Oklahoma. We are here to share stories, provide resources, answer your questions, and most importantly, celebrate the incredible individuals in our community. So with that, let's get down to the basics. Today, we're diving into a very important topic, IEPs, Individualized Education Plans. These plans are critical tools in ensuring students with disabilities get the supports they need to be successful in school. And I'm thrilled to be joined today with Lucia Frawling, who is with the Oklahoma Parents for Student Achievement, and she's kind of been our IEP consultant and helped many of our families at DASCO. Thanks, Lucia, for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sarah. I'm really excited to talk about IEPs and hopefully help families be a little more confident into going into meetings and advocating for their child.
Mm-hmm. So I know I've used you a lot for services for Kirsten, but can you just kind of start off, because IEPs have changed in the last 18 to 20 years for sure, but can you just kind of talk through what an IEP is and how, for those new families that are starting out, what we need to do in that first three-year-old inner school?
Perfect. Yes. So for some families, they will be transitioning from what's known as early intervention services, or Sooner Start, as it's called in Oklahoma. Yep. And typically you would have someone, if you are receiving those services, attend that transition meeting for you. But let's say that that hasn't happened and your child is 3, 4, or 5 and you want them to receive services from your local public school. So the local public school where you live, or if your child is enrolled in a private school where that private school is located, is responsible for something called Child Find. And that means evaluating all students suspected of having a disability within their public school boundaries and determining if they qualify for special education services. And so that can be for students who might have a more visible disability or for students who might have one that's not so visible. So the first thing that parents will want to do is to reach out to the public school district and ask for what's called a review of existing data meeting. So that means if you have any information about your child from your child care provider or any private therapies you're receiving or your pediatrician, you would want to share that information. And then when you do that, you'll have your review of existing data meeting. It would open up consent that you would sign. And that starts the clock. Okay. So the school has 45 school days from when you sign consent to start the evaluation process to finish all the evaluations and determine if your child qualifies for special education services. And as a parent, you are the most important member of that team that will make that determination.
So even individuals who have Down syndrome will have to go through this process.
Yes.
Even if they already have a documented disability.
Yes, because what they're looking for is educational need. And so all individuals are beautifully and wonderfully made different.
Absolutely.
And so one student with Down syndrome might have different educational needs mm-hmm. than another student. So for some students, they might have more concerns regarding articulation. And maybe another student, it's more the pragmatic, those like we're having, conversational
right.
skills that they're needing help in. And so what they do, and that's called a full psychoeducational evaluation. So that means you are wanting to look at adaptive behavior. You are wanting to look at their speech and language. You are wanting to look at their academic skills. An important thing to realize is there are different eligibility categories. There's 13 under IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so certain tests or evaluations have to be done to meet the criteria, that suspected category. So I think one thing for parents that they want to be aware of is what area you think your student has a suspected disability in. So I would encourage parents to look at which we can include in the show notes, a link mm-hmm. to Oklahoma's Evaluation and Eligibility Handbook. Okay. Because you want to look really closely at other health impairment, and you might want to look really closely at intellectual disabilities because they have different requirements. And a student can become eligible under different eligibility categories. You might have okay. multiple ones that you could be eligible under, and it's okay. kind of like what bucket fills up first. Right. But if a parent feels really strongly about not wanting the cognitive test of their child, mm-hmm. which would be relevant to the IQ test, because they're scared about placement of their child,
right.
then they might want to look closely at a suspected disability category of other health impairment, because we do know some individuals with Down syndrome have concomitant disabilities, which would mean something like they might have had to have had heart surgery, they might right. have a seizure disorder, they might have asthma, that would qualify them under other health impairment mm-hmm. that they might feel more appropriately describes their child.
Or celiac disease.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know my journey with IEPs in the beginning, just to share to our listeners out there, so Kirsten did transition from Sooner Start into the school system, and we just continued her therapies there. So she started out with her IEP, and the whole reason for it was to get her ready for kindergarten. So she didn't go to they didn't have a preschool at the school there. She actually went to a private daycare and did that there. But we had speech, OT, and PT, and I took her to the school to do those services early in the morning. And then I will say, could you just kind of share a little bit like the importance of the IEP team? Because I think some parents don't even know who to include in that process. And I know I was kind of deer in the headlights, and I went and I was so overwhelmed because I didn't even know what I was asking for.
Yes, that is definitely a huge concern, and one I was nervous myself. I have three kids, two of whom are on IEPs in public school. And after that evaluation meeting I was talking about, the school has 30 days to develop an IEP, 30 mm-hmm. calendar days, individualized education program, which talks about the program and services that that student's going to receive. And the school often draft it. It's a right. draft. It is their offer of a free and appropriate public education. It is a legal contract. And just like you probably wouldn't go buy a car by yourself, you wouldn't buy a house by yourself. You have someone to walk you through that.
Right.
So I always recommend having a support person mm-hmm. attend the meeting with you for two very important reasons. One, mm-hmm. another set of ears is always helpful because it can be really overwhelming. And second is just to have other people that know your child. So that could be their Sunday school mm-hmm. teacher. That could be their private child care provider. That could be their private therapist. Mm-hmm. That could be an advocate like myself.
Or a private tutor. I think we had yes. that. We've also had therapists join in on that. Or at least I always got like a summary of what she was working on in the private sector therapies for them to maybe incorporate in school or work towards some of the same goals.
Absolutely. I think that's so important because you want to make sure that whatever they're working on, maybe in their private therapies, that they're not working on a skill that's below them in right. public school because they might not know them as well.
Right.
And they have two different approaches. So you want them to work together. Another thing that I always encourage parents to do is to record the meetings.
Oh, that's good information.
Oklahoma is a one-party state, which mm-hmm. means only one party in the conversation has to consent to being recorded. So that doesn't mean you can, you know, leave your recording device in the room and walk out. That would not be allowed.
Right.
However, it is important, I feel, to record the conversation because it does get emotional and our memories can be so tricky. Our brains mm-hmm. are tricky of remembering what was said, and it helps you to remember and have a record to go back on. I always recommend telling the school that you're recording and, you know, putting your recording device out on the table or letting them know beforehand. The school then does have the right to record as well, mm-hmm. and that becomes part of your child's educational record. Well, that's great, because yeah. what if something happens to your recording? Well, then the school also has one.
Oh, that's good.
So I think it just helps everyone to be on the same page, and if your spouse can't be there or you're wanting to tell your grandma about what happened, will you have a recording to say, this is what was said, this is what we agreed to. And after every meeting, you'll receive something called a written notice, which is a summary of the meeting. And so if you have a recording to go back on, you can make sure that nothing was accidentally missed and correct anything that has been misstated or that you would like added to make sure there's a record of what was stated in the meeting. The other thing I recommend is always ask for any documents at least 3 to 5 school days beforehand.
Okay.
Because you want time to absorb the information, think of questions to write. So always put that in writing to the district, whoever the case manager is, the teacher of record, or the principal, if that's who you're working with, or the school psychologist, and ask them, hey, I really need to have all documentation at least 3 to 5 school days in advance of the meeting. So I can be an equal team member. And that includes the MEGS, which is the evaluation group summary. And that's what I was talking about earlier. That determines what eligibility category that your student will qualify under. And that is also has to be redone every 3 years or every year upon parent request, like if you think other things want to be looked at. So you always want to get those documents beforehand. And remember, it's a draft. So you're supposed to work together, and you are a member of the team, so you want to make sure your voice is interwoven.
And it can be changed anytime.
Absolutely.
Because I know when I first start, they're like, oh, no, once you've signed, it's on the dotted line. You can't make any changes to that. And I learned later on, oh, yes, you can. I tried to always kind of be the proactive side, and before the IEP meeting took place, I always sent what my expectations were. I don't like to always call them goals. I like to say expectations of what I wanted Kirsten to work on or achieve for that school year. And then my concerns, like if she was having any health concerns that year, especially any upcoming surgeries that we had. And she had a lot of ENT issues. So I wanted to make sure everybody on the IEP team knew that, you know, sometimes her speech delay might be because of the hearing issues that she was having and all of those tubes that she had multiples of. So I think that was kind of always my approach. Is that a good approach to take?
Absolutely, because just like you probably can't expect your husband to read your mind as much as I would like mine to read my mind, as long as we've been married, I can't. I also can't expect the school to read my mind of what I think is important and what I see for my child's future, what you see for your child's future. Only you know that. And so we're supposed to work together as a team to get to those goals, because I presume competence.
And then speaking of team, too, from the day one we started the IEP process, Kirsten has been in every single IEP meeting. Whether she understood some of those discussions or not, she knew we were discussing her. And I always felt that that was important, and I always made her sign her IEP. Because to me, that's something beneficial to her. And I actually had a teacher one time tell us that she didn't need to learn to sign her name. So we changed that, Nicole, real quick.
Absolutely.
She said, well, she's going to sign her IEP, so why not? But I know those early ages, it's just kind of that overwhelming sensation for families. So any suggestions on how they can, like, prepare for that first IEP meeting besides what you had mentioned earlier, emotionally?
I think the best thing to do is think about what your child can do. Think about your dream for their future. Think about what their strengths are.
Yeah.
Because sometimes these evaluations, they are normed across, you know, all range of students. And so when you're looking at a percentile or looking at a scaled score, okay, so what? I'm looking at the narrative of what they're saying about my child. I'm looking at where the high points in the scoring to see what their strengths are. And we want to focus on that. And so I think the other part is not having all the meetings together. I don't ever think it's a good idea to have the MEGS meeting and then have the IEP right after. I at least want a few days in there because it's so much information. And I know we're, as parents, anxious to get, you know, services started, all of those things. We want to do it right. And of course, while you always can come back to the IEP table, it is easier to start off correct, on the correct pathway, rather than having to go back. And the other thing I would caution parents on to be prepared is being very clear about your expectation of, I expect my child to be in the least restrictive environment, of which there's one, which is a general education setting. Mm-hmm. And let's start the discussion there. That let's say my child's going to be there 100% of the day. Now, are they likely to be? Probably not, because there will be a need for pull-out services. But Correct. Let's start the conversation there.
Yes.
And then if they can't be successful in the least restrictive environment, maximizing out supplementary aids and services, such as an aid, mm-hmm. such as visual schedules, all those other things, then we look on the continuum of placements mm-hmm. for more restrictive options. The services are portable. So mm-hmm. that includes OT, PT, speech. That includes your special education, your specially designed instruction. Mm-hmm. Those can be pushed in. Sometimes there's a need for them to get pulled out, particularly mm-hmm. if you're working on doing certain sounds. Maybe there needs right. to be a quieter environment right. or something like that.
Or if there's some sensory issues. I know that was some concerns of mine of her sitting for very long. She sometimes couldn't do that. Yes. She would want to get up and roam. But the goal was, we're going to learn to sit in the classroom the full time, but exactly. we might need to have a couple of breaks in there,
absolutely.
And that's absolutely okay. So we kind of transition from, you know, those early ages, we've hit kindergarten, now we're kind of getting into the more academics, and I know that's where a lot of families have a hard time, like, developing, you know, real goals, because we all want our kids to learn math and reading and stay on the grade level that they are. And sometimes that isn't always possible for every single child with Down syndrome, but that doesn't mean that that's not the expectation. And I think sometimes in those IEP meetings, it's like, well, we'll just pull them back. And we're like, no, let's push them forward. So if there's any suggestions you have in those, you know, elementary years of how to set some real goals.
Yes. Well, I always say, in looking at the way that children learn, the multisensory approach is super important. So when you're looking at goals and then you're looking at the grade level curriculum, of making sure that there are certain entry points, which mm-hmm. is why it's called UDL, the Universal Design of Learning. And I might be saying it a little wrong. thank you. So it's creating those entry points within the lesson plan for all students.
Right.
That means from on this end all the way to this end. And making sure that there's entry points. So looking at those goals of, it needs to be data-driven, first of all.
Okay.
So is it that they need to work on phonemic awareness? Is mm-hmm. it, which is the sounds? There's mm-hmm. 26 letters in the alphabet. There's 44 phonemes, which are the sounds that we use in the English language that make up words. So is it that they need to work on that? Is it that they need to work on their one-to-one rote counting correspondence? And when you're looking at elementary and those academic standards, the biggest thing is presuming competence, because when we presume competence and we have high expectations, then our students are going to rise to meet them.
Absolutely.
So I would caution parents on, if they are saying that your child needs an alternate curriculum, before you go that route, how can we modify mm-hmm. the general education curriculum?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be really careful that you are getting your students getting exposure to that, mm-hmm. because how can they possibly make progress in the general education curriculum if they're never exposed to it? And then that can create the Matthew effect, where the gap widens because they haven't been exposed to what their general education peers are being exposed to.
I had a family not too long ago, and the school was having a hard time modifying the curriculum for this specific student, and the mom used ChatGPT. And said, here you go. Like, and she made some modifications to it as well. But there's so many resources out there, I feel, now for teachers to do those modifications, you know, for the least restricted environment. And I think sometimes that kind of gets lost in the process, too. And I feel like, I know in my experiences, we've always kind of had to think outside of the box.
Absolutely.
And get creative with our kids, especially in how they learn. And I feel like sometimes I had to be on repeat to explain how Kirsten was learning differently. And that was always frustrating, because you didn't want to have to say the same things over and over. And, you know, you're moving from one grade to the other, so you've got new teachers, especially in some of those, you know, bigger schools. But, you know, what I'm getting at is, I think, you know, going back to, this is their individualized education plan. This is about the individual. And I always did those one pagers for every grade level to kind of show everybody where she's at. And again, you know, now there's so many options. I know Kathy and I've talked about this before, just in the office briefly, but when our children started school, the thought of going to college was not all that attainable here in Oklahoma and really wasn't even on our radar. And now we have parents who are starting their IEP process early on saying, how do we get there? And I think that's probably the big question. What things do they need to start putting in place today on their IEP so they're ready for college?
Absolutely. So in that regard, I think that's the important part about sharing your vision for your child. Like, this is our expectation. And now let's scaffold it back of what do we need to work on now? And what exposure do they need now? And the great thing about having AI and about having, you know, a camera in our pocket,
yeah,
is if there's something at home that's working for you and your child that they can show their knowledge. Because what we want to be careful of is if there might be someone at the school saying, well, they don't know this, and you know that they do, it might be they're not able to express it in the way that they're being assessed.
Right.
So we might need to adjust the assessment procedure and put that as an accommodation in their IEP. So you as a parent or a tutor recording how that student is giving you information and how you are assessing them, how you're working with them, what tools you're using, then utilizing that information in the school setting can help that student to be successful.
Okay, I have a question because this gets asked in our office frequently where we're in this elementary age and we've started field trips. And I get parents who ask, well, they wouldn't let, you know, Susie go on the field trip. So do things like that have to be written in the IEP? I mean, you'd think common sense would check in at some point.
Yes.
But this is a safety issue for the school. And we know they can't go on the field trip. How do we address things like that on our IEPs, or should it even be on there?
I think if it's not in writing, then it didn't happen.
Okay.
And so the great thing about the parent concerns section is that's for anything a parent wants to say.
Okay,
that's
great.
The really only part of the IEP where you get to put everything in. And so I always want to encourage parents to put at the top of their parent concerns, copy and paste verbatim, do not paraphrase, and to put in with their concerns and their expectations. Because I'm a non-attorney special education advocate, so I can't interpret law. However, my understanding is when we talk about the things that the general education students are doing, students who receive special education services are general education students first.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the field trip or those kind of things, the conversation you need to have is, what support does my child need and will the school provide for my student to be successful on a field trip? Because the expectation is that they're going. And so putting it in writing as a supplementary aid in service or as an accommodation, or it doesn't matter where it is necessarily in the IEP, as long as it's in there in writing of, okay, well, this student is going to need a one-to-one enhanced adult support, paraprofessional, whatever they're calling it, to be successful on this field trip because there is an elopement risk or there's a safety concern,
mm-hmm.
then that's what we do. Because that might be when also there is a fire drill that
right.
that person needs an additional person with them, that student needs additional support. They might not need that in the classroom mm-hmm. setting, but they might need it in a setting that is outside their norm.
Mm-hmm.
And so putting that in there is important. The other thing is if you do get that comment, then you... it's not in writing, it didn't happen, I would encourage a parent to respond with the email saying, can you please show me the policy and yes, and the state statute informing your policy that is informing your decision that my child is being denied access to this field trip
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is that they're being denied access to, because that is important. And I have yet to see a school policy or a state statute being referenced by a school district in my experience where allowing a student to be denied access to a field trip or an extracurricular activity has been allowed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of us have kind of had issues with that. And I know sometimes, you know, when we come into an IEP meeting, I tell parents this all the time. It's about building a relationship. And Kathy and I talked about this on a previous podcast when we discussed, you know, our experiences in school systems. And it really kind of goes back. You've really got to build the relationship with your IEP team, and because your IEP team is going to change over the years as your child goes into each grade level. And I think specifically for Kirsten, I started seeing her develop into seeing the things that she wanted to do and just kind of followed, you know, her path with falling into cheerleading and FFA. And I know a lot of parents, they're like, oh, well, you know, he really likes to play basketball. And I'm like, well, why aren't you having him on the basketball team or being a part of that or practices or whatever works for you and for him that, you know, he can do, like going back to the cans. And so I think, you know, when we move on from the elementary age into middle school to me is where we really have to work hard on an inclusion process. So any thoughts to share in that transition? Because then we move into the transition phase and work study and getting ready for the diplomas and all that. So let's first talk about middle school and some suggestions for that.
Absolutely. So with middle school, that is a weird time for all students. Yeah. Either your body's changing, your brain's changing, all the different things. And on the inclusion aspect, we have amazing teachers in Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of emergency certified teachers who are filling that role because they're called, their heart is called. Did you know in the IEP, there's a place for teacher training? It's under the LRE considerations, which is towards the back of the IEP. There's a little box of anything that's not personnel support, is what it's called. Describe any supplementary aids and services not mentioned before or personnel support. That is a great place to put training because we have our special education teachers that are the case managers. However, our students are general education students first. So what training do those general education teachers have in inclusive practices? What training do they have in UDL? What training and what support do they need? And so I always look to looking at the collaboration model or the co-teaching model in middle school. And collaboration means that the special education teacher is collaborating with the general education teacher to meet those students' needs in the general education setting. And co-teaching is a special education teacher and a general education teacher both delivering instruction. And I'm paraphrasing here. It's in the policy procedures manual, which we can include in our in the show notes. So parents can look up what the different types of service delivery models are. I think that's really important to look at. And you also want to look at the setting. So when you're going through their IEP, look at the goals and then ask the question, where can we implement this goal at? Where are we going to work on this goal? What interventions? Who's going to be delivering it? And when, if they say, well, the special education teacher in the special education setting, well, why? And because there might be needs where there needs to be a separate setting, or there might not be. And if you've, the teacher's always done it that way, or it's been their practice in their school, it's been the way that they were taught, or their mentor told them, or some other misinformation they might have, that doesn't mean we always do it that way. You know, with all the different diets that are around, we learn and we do better and we eat differently. Well, the same thing in education. And we don't know until we've tried it. So I always want to start again like that 100% inclusion in general education setting and thinking about it, and then where do we need to pull out? And so it's really important for those peer modeling is a great time in middle school, because if you have a student receiving special education services in a class, like let's say science, and you have another student that struggles, well, if they are paired, if they are paired together, that might allow another student to really rise and be a leader. And what better way to demonstrate understanding of a topic than when you're helping someone else understand it as well?
Retaining, I'm sure, is better.
And my cousin is a sixth grade science teacher in the eastern side of the state. She has every single student in her classroom at some part of the day. Every single student. It does not matter if they are on an IEP, a 504, whatever it is, or general education student not receiving any kind of services or support formally. She has those students in her classroom, including individuals with Down syndrome. She modifies the work, and they are able to demonstrate understanding of the topic in their unique way. Mm-hmm. And that's how it should be in every single classroom. Absolutely. And I know it's possible.
Absolutely. I totally agree. So I know middle school, there's a lot of changes, a lot going on, and students are switching classrooms for the first time. And I know I always ask that an aide kind of go with Kirsten the first, you know, couple months maybe, or even maybe the first month for sure, just to get her acclimated. And I remember when she started middle school, I did write it in her IEP that she was going to have a locker, because they were not going to let her have a locker. She could just put her stuff in the special ed classroom. And I said, well, everybody else has a locker.
Right.
So why can't she have one? And
agreed.
She wanted a locker.
Absolutely.
So I think just, you know, having an understanding, our kids want the same things as their peers.
Absolutely.
And they're watching their behaviors and watching them. And so if you could just kind of continue to share about that middle school transition part and what things we should specifically be asking for.
I think with middle school, it's really important. That's also when you have a lot of, typically when sports start.
Yes.
And those extracurricular
Yes.
activities. And so really thinking about, what does that look like for my student, and what are their interests? Like you talked mm-hmm. about, Kirsten, with FFA and with cheerleading. And
yes.
Thinking about, what can it look like? And thinking of creative solutions. Mm-hmm. Because just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean it can't be done. And I also want to make sure we're looking at things that are not token gestures, but meaningful inclusion, where the
right.
student is a part of their school culture and a part of the community, where they're not a guest in the classroom. They're not someone that's trotted out for a photo op.
Right.
That's not what our students are supposed to be. They are every right to be wherever their peers are.
I had a parent tell me one time, you know, our kids, we don't necessarily want our kids to always stand out. We just want them to blend in.
Absolutely.
And I think that key word of blending in is part of the inclusion process. And I say, my recommendation is start early. Like, if you want your kid on the basketball team, then get them integrated in middle school and get that going. And even having them on leagues with in the YMCA, you know, early on, so that they can play the t-ball, play the baseball, whatever. They don't always have to be the manager or the cleanup crew. They
yes.
can be a part of the team. And you and I have had that
yes.
discussion
several
times.
A lot of feelings about that.
Yeah. But it's so good for their social skills. And yes. kids with Down syndrome, we know, lack that social connection and understanding. And the more they're around their peers and have that integration, especially starting in middle school, I always, you know, think the better. But as we kind of get into middle school, there's, you know, a lot going on with that. And then we kind of start talking about the transition process.
Yes.
What does that look like?
So
I get parents ask this, and they're like, I don't even know what that means, Sarah.
Exactly. So we hear this word transition, and it can have a multitude of meanings. So I think in this context, we are talking about the whole point of IDEA is to, the tenets of what it's based upon, is to prepare students for further education, employment, and independent living.
Yes.
So those three things. Well, the education piece, okay, we know that's, you know, K-12, pre-K, you know, preschool
right.
through grade 12 or after,
right.
if that is what is needed. And so we're thinking about employment and independent living, and how early do we start that?
Mm.
And so I know you and I both serve on the Oklahoma Rehabilitation Council together. We both serve on the Oklahoma Transition Council.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Pathways to Partnership grant that we worked with through the State Department of Education and Department of Rehabilitation Services, they've talked about dialing and drilling down transition starting at age 10.
Absolutely. I'm all in favor of that.
Yes. Because, like, what do they need? What soft skills? I mean, is it having their own lemonade stand? Is it doing, you know, a multitude of other things that they're being in Girl Scouts, being in Boy Scouts, of whatever it is, with their peers?
Yep.
So that's, those extracurricular activities are really important. And then as we're going into middle school, there's something called pre-EDS, pre-employment transition services, that starts at age 14. And then we have Department of Rehabilitation Services. It starts at age 16, but you definitely want to apply around 15 and a half.
Right.
So you get services going, which I know DASCO does a lot of work with too.
Right.
And y'all's self-advocacy group as the kids, as the students get older. So what we're talking about in the school setting, what does that mean? And so I want parents to know that means community involvement. That means work skills. That means life skills. And think about the things when you're thinking of transition planning of what can you do at home and what needs to be done at school, because there are certain things that need to be done at school, academics and the social connections and the social skills. For some parents, they might need help with some of those functional life skills happening in the school setting. And for other parents, I know like for you and Kathy, it's really important that you guys do that at home. You don't want that time used up in the only, you know, 7 hours of school they have per day at school.
Right.
You guys have taken responsibility for, you know, like you do with all your kids.
Yeah. She does her own laundry. She has chores at home that she has to do and cleaning. Now, she likes to do those things, but I'd rather her focus at school be on some other areas where she has some weaknesses in and needs to strengthen those. Reading is one of them.
Absolutely.
I know a lot of schools don't have a great system set up for parents to talk about transition. I think they just don't know. And so, I mean, I was kind of one of those that kind of fell in that gap. It was kind of a new thing. It's not a new thing, but it was like, well, we don't really know that much about it. So where can parents go to get information about transition services?
Oh, this is great because it just launched in March. We were at the meeting. So planyourwayok.com is for everyone in Oklahoma, just not students with disabilities. It's for everyone, where you can see all the resources, because our state, Oklahoma, actually does a really great job in transition services and planning.
Yeah, they do.
Just most folks don't know about it. And so the secret's out. So go to planyourwayok.com, and there are tons of resources and connections with agencies. I would also highly recommend going to reaching out to Department of Rehabilitation Services, and especially if you have a student who is, you know, eighth grade and up, so that 14
years.
Yes, it might be, depending if your child is, you know, maybe in sixth grade at 14, then starting at that, not necessarily that grade they're in, but the age they're at, to start those services, because you do have more access to more resources, because we don't think about transition planning means budgeting.
Right.
It means filling out a job application. It means signing your name. All of those things are so important. And we want to make sure that the goals that are built into the IEP for transition services make sense for your child and what their interests are.
Is there a separate spot on the IEP in that age category for transition services?
There is, once they're going. In Oklahoma, it tends to be once they're age of 15 is typically when it starts, but which is why it's important for parents to know what they can do before then, because transition services in schools don't typically start until 8th or 9th grade. And so we want to make sure that regardless if it's in that official section of the IEP, you can still weave it in there through goals that are in other areas that are related or transition adjacent, such as the budgeting and reading goals and those things that are those foundational skills. And the other thing I want to make parents aware of as we go into, you know, such as we're talking about going into high school, is there is a bill that's been signed by the governor. It's House Bill 1393. And what that bill talks about is consent for parents, because I think parents should know that Oklahoma is what's considered, well, now partial consent, but before a non-consent state, which means as a parent, you are only responsible for consenting to evaluations of your child and the initial provision of services. So after that, if something changes in the IEP, if their placement changes, which means like where they're receiving their education at, if the goals are changing, you're supposed to come to consensus as a team, but if you can't come to consensus, then the school can decide what the offer of FAPE, free appropriate public education, will be. And you can mark disagree, and the school can implement it anyway. And so we've worked with a lot of DASCO families as well as other parent advocacy groups, and realized that, unfortunately, in some districts, not all, that being on the Oklahoma Alternate Assessment Program, OAAP or OAP, was driving placement. Because unfortunately, there was a misunderstanding that an alternate assessment meant an alternate curriculum, meant an alternate setting. And my understanding of what ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, from other people have said who are way smarter than me, is that you can only have an alternate diploma or alternate assessment if it allows you access to and progress in the general education curriculum. And so we worked with some great legislators and with parents really leading the charge. Of now, starting July 1st, the State Department will create forms and more detailed information about what OAP is. If you look on your IP you have at home, it's after the objective statement. It'll say assessments between double black bars. And it says, if you're student participating, yes or no. If it's yes, they'll fill out some information. And there's actually a rubric that goes along with that that you should fill out together as a team. Some districts were putting students on at age 3, 4, and 5. State testing doesn't start until third grade, and the alternate assessment means that they are, you know, supposed to mean you're in the general education curriculum and you might be assessed by a different standard. And when you, also when you're on the alternate assessment, that leads to the alternate diploma pathway, and not alternate diploma Oklahoma. We also have two alternate diplomas, so that can be confusing, but in this context we're talking about alternate diploma, meaning that it's not the standard diploma because you haven't met the standard graduation requirements. There is a separate alternate diploma that is for students, you know, if you're dropping out or those things, which isn't necessarily the, the families we're speaking to today. So on that one, now, starting July 1st, it's very important for parents to know going into this new IEP season or the new school year, you cannot put a student on OAP without parental consent. The parents can consent to their child being assessed by OAP or not. And it is supposed to be a yearly decision.
Is there, are there benefits to that or not? Like, what's the difference? Distinguish that for us.
So if you're on the standard diploma track, once you're assessed, you take the standard test, OSTP, and you also take the standard, you know, district assessments, and you're supposed to make progress in and achieve, be assessed by the, this higher grade level standard. And the when you receive your standard diploma, the district's obligation to provide a free, appropriate public education ends. So for a lot of students, you know, that's age 18, might be 19 or so. So if you are on the OAP, the alternate diploma, you will still typically walk with your cohort, your four-year cohort that you would typically graduate if you're on the standard diploma track. And then you can return up until age 22, the school year in which you turn 22, for transition services. Now, what that can also mean is that, let's say you're on OAP and it was really because your student struggled with math. So they receive this alternate diploma. Well, when they come back for transition services, if they want to keep working on achieving that grade level standard in their Algebra 2 so they can get that final credit, my understanding from talking to some people at the State Department and people who used to work there and some other superintendents is that they can still attempt that. It's giving them time to attempt that. And there in Oklahoma, we have four IPSE programs, which is post-secondary education. So I'm sure some of you have heard of Riverhawks. There's the one at University of Science and Arts of Oklahoma. There is one Orange Scholar at OSU, and then there's Sooner Works at OU. So those four programs, if you're on OAP and receive the alternate diploma, as well as Project Search, that that's a good pathway. If the student wants to attend and receive a associate's degree or go on for a bachelor's degree and receive that particular degree, being having an alternate diploma and not having the standard diploma as well may impede some of that access. And so I think it's really important for parents to understand what the implication is. And if your child is on OAP, That is a parental decision completely, if they are, if they aren't. And so that's why this consent was made, because it really is a parent decision, because it does have future implications. It's really important to talk to the school team and me and discuss that if my student's on OAP, that doesn't mean they're in an alternate setting. And so making sure there's a realization of what your plan is for your child's future, mm-hmm. because we live in an inclusive society.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
There's not a special needs bank or grocery store, Target. There's not. It's for everyone.
Right.
So school is for everyone.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that we're having those inclusive experiences and having not even experiences, that's not the right word, having an inclusive culture mindset, mm-hmm. because that's important for all students to work with people who learn in all different ways.
Mm-hmm. I feel the pain in all of those things, because we just kind of went through that with Kirsten. And I think you don't know what you don't know. And but you know what you want for your child. And I know, like with her transition part, she worked in the school. And I think that's where she kind of felt most comfortable at right. that time. But now that she's done that, I'm like, okay, well, now we're going to try to find some external employment since right. she's graduated and she's continuing on with her transition services. I don't know if she'll stay till she's 22. We'll kind of just see how she does. And maybe she might be ready for the next thing later on. But I think now trying to piece it all together is where it's a little foggy for me, because we don't really have a great plan. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing by any means. I just don't know what Kirsten wants to do, what her strengths are. She's doing Best Step Camp this summer.
Oh, that's great.
So I think we'll figure out after that, you know, what her strengths are in the workforce. We do know that she likes to manage money, so maybe that will be her thing. But I think as our kids are in that high school age group, we go back to the inclusive thing again. I feel like sometimes things revert back in high school because there's just a lot going on. And then, you know, we've had to talk about her being a part of the cheer team. And I just really encourage parents for you to find what your child's interests are. If they want to be in the drama club or the German club, or if they want to, you know, be in the choir, there's no reason. That's great for speech development, I've heard. There's no reason why they can't do those things or be a part of those things. And from my experiences, Kirsten has learned so much by being in the extracurricular activities, even more so than in the classroom from her peers. And her peers have learned from her as well. So could you kind of just share a little bit about all of that inclusive education going yes. into adulthood?
Absolutely. So when we talk about inclusive education, one, I think from every teacher that I have met that has really had the opportunity to have true meaningful inclusion, it has made them a better educator, mm-hmm. because it's not something that they learned in college. I hope that changes, but that's right. currently where we're at. So kudos to our teachers, because it takes a lot on their own.
And I will say, we're not here to call teachers out.
Absolutely not.
We're not here to call out the IEP team. We're really just here to all educate each other.
Absolutely.
About what's best for our kid. It really has nothing to do with me. This is her plan. This
exactly.
is what she's going to do. And I think sometimes our families do get caught in those situations where, you know, the rest of the IEP teams feels attacked.
Right.
And that's where it can get a little heated.
And I think in those situations, totally understandable, it's mm-hmm. your child.
Mm-hmm.
You are the expert on your child. And I think when you keep it about the student, which is why I think it's important, like you were saying, Kirsten comes to her meetings. Mm-hmm. I understand it can be hard for students to sit through the whole thing, because
sure.
Especially when you're talking about deficits.
Yeah.
Skill development, that can be hard. So I think at least having your student at the beginning to share their wishes, mm-hmm. what they love, because I have a student, her favorite class all day is science.
Oh.
That is where she's with her gen ed peers.
Mm.
And so why she might not be making progress in that class like you would expect her to or want her to, for the social development, and she is making progress,
mm-hmm.
it's important. It's what's important to her. And she might not show it in the traditional way of the other students, but it's important. But the other thing we're doing, which gets to this, the post-secondary of what happens and why inclusive education is important, is the other kids in the classroom. Those students are going to be your child's coworkers.
Right.
Might be their boss. Right. Your child might be their boss.
Right.
That's who they're going to be in community with. Mm-hmm. And so having inclusive education teaches you to work with kids and work with others of all ability levels. It teaches you to be more kind and understanding and empathetic and those soft skills that are so important today and that every student really could, all of us could use development in. And if you segregate children, you're segregating students, then you are unfortunately, I feel, teaching an inherent bias of if you have a disability, then maybe you should not be seen and not be heard, and you should be at the back of somewhere and not out in front. Mm-hmm. Everyone can see you. That's not appropriate, and that's not what we want to teach. Mm-hmm. And our kids are capable. Mm-hmm. When we see these, you know, Instagram influencer, I follow a lot of individuals with Down syndrome, that's not an anomaly.
Right.
Shouldn't be.
No.
That's what every child is capable of. Mm-hmm. When we presume competence and we have inclusive education and we have where they are a part of their school culture like we all should be and a part of our community like we all should be. So that, I think that's why that part is so important, because then you have employees who understand how to work with someone else that might learn differently and they need to adjust their approach. And so when we do that, we are building a better society as a whole.
Well, and I'll just add to that. Our kids have feelings, and they know when they're being excluded. And they know when they are being treated unfairly and unkind. And to think that they don't, you know, shame on you for thinking that. And I'll give you a great example. And I'll even say, every time I had an expectation for Kirsten, she far exceeded it. And I was like, gosh, did I set the bar too low for her, you know, in my mothering? But every time, like, she would, we, like, okay, we're going to try to show sheep. How is that going to work? I knew that was going to be hard on all of us. And, you know, she just met, she saw the kids do it, and she implemented everything they were doing. She learned from watching them.
Absolutely.
And I think that goes for any discipline, anything that they're trying to do. But, you know, Kirsten just graduated, and this happened with Kathy as well. She kind of had a breakdown and started crying right after the ceremony. And I could not understand why. And sometimes our kids interpret sadness and they'll say, oh, my stomach's hurting. And it's just the anxiety. So later on that evening, I said, why were you crying? She goes, Mom, because I'm sad. It's over. So to know that she's experiencing the same emotions as everyone else, and these are her friends. And I think, you know, in all, you know, academics are great. And of course, we're always wanting to achieve those things. We want our kid to move to the next goal or the next thing. But it doesn't always have to be like that, you know. No. School can be so much more than just, you know, reading and writing for our kids in particular. And that's how they learn best. Keep in mind, people with Down syndrome are relationship. They want to build a relationship. They've got to connect with the person, like, you know, in their soul before they'll do anything for them. But I think that really encompassed everything of Kirsten's. She kind of put it all into perspective for me. Like, I realized she loves this place. She feels safe here. And she has her own, you know, set of goals.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's encouraging for those of you just starting out on this journey and not knowing what an IEP is. And, you know, Lucia's a great, great resource. And I would just say, you know, Lucia, what's like the top three best advice you could give to, you know, families moving forward?
Oh, that's pretty easy, actually. So your favorite phrase is going to be, what is the policy? Please show me the policy. Because sometimes you will hear, we've never done that, we can't do that. And it's just misinformation. It is not a bash on anyone. It's right. just you might have misunderstood. We all do. Mm. And so can you please show me the policy that is informing your decision?
Show me the policy.
Yes. Show me the policy. Because if they're saying no, I need to know why.
Yeah.
The second thing is if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. Mm. And so if you've had that great conversation with your teacher about, hey, I think a visual schedule is really going to help Johnny, then follow up with the teacher. If right. you were already using a visual schedule at home, then offer to share it. Mm-hmm. You know what? I would be happy to create that for you because your teacher does have a ton on their plate. And so I think that's really important to establish that rapport, that relationship, that uh-huh. teamwork of, hey, you know, you said we were going to do this visual schedule. Can I help you with that? Mm-hmm. And asking for help because, you know, we'd want to generalize that visual schedule across all settings, right? Mm-hmm. That would be really important. And so following up so the teacher remembers, because we all forget things, it's also helpful for your memory. And then the third thing is you do not have to know everything. You do not have to be an expert in special education law. You don't have to be an expert in curriculum. You are the expert in your child. Mm. So realizing that your voice is the most important and sharing that, sharing your expectations, sharing your hope, your vision, and knowing you're not going to agree on everything. It would be weird if at the IEP team table that you all immediately agree on everything, because I don't agree with my husband every day mm. and I love him dearly.
Right.
But that's normal.
Right.
And it doesn't mean it's aggressive. It doesn't mean it's uncomfortable. It just means help me understand. So that could be the other third part of building that relationship and knowing that it's okay to disagree is help me understand. If you say that, that can be a gentler approach.
Right.
Of then I don't think you're right. What are you even saying? You have three heads. It's help me understand where you're coming from, and then telling them, well, this is my understanding. This is where I'm coming from. And sharing it in that way, I think, can go far. And I'm here to help. My team's here to help. Dasco, Sarah, and Kathy and their whole team are here to help and lean on each other, because that's important.
Yeah, I've learned so much from my mentors and friends through how to navigate the IEP process, for sure. But I will just say all those resources and links that Lucia mentioned today, we will have listed throughout the podcast in the links provided. So be sure and check those out, because those are really good resources. We'll also post them on our DASCO website. But Lucia, thank you so much. And thank you for helping our families, because I don't know all the answers to this for sure, but I know when they call and they're like in a panic, I don't know what to do and how do I navigate this? I'm like, call Lucia. she'll take care of you. And sometimes it just takes, you know, Lucia writing a letter to the school to change some things on the IEP. But like she said, ask for the policy. But again, Lucia's with the Oklahoma Parents for Student Achievement. You can look them up on the website. We'll have a link. But we hope that you've enjoyed this episode of talking about IEPs, and stay tuned, because we have many more very important conversations ahead talking about advocacy and real life stories from some of our self-advocates. We also want to hear from you. So if you have questions, ideas, topics that you'd like for us to cover, please reach out. If you have questions about the session today, about your specific IEP, please give us a call. We'll get you connected with Lucia. But in the meantime, you can email us at info@dsaco.org or visit our website at dsaco.org. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with a friend or family on social media, because we would like to spread the awareness the stronger our community becomes. Thank you for being with us on this episode of DASCO Up for Discussion. We can't wait to continue this journey with you. Until next time, remember, every step forward is a step toward a more inclusive world. Thank you.
Thank you.